From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Stanley Huck Gutman of Burlington, a retired professor of English at the University of Vermont, who writes and distributes a poetry newsletter with an avid and widespread following. I've long wanted to interview Huck about his newsletter. An American academic and political advisor, Huck Gutman was chair of the UVM English Department from 1997 to 2000. He served as chief of staff in the office of Senator Bernie Sanders from 2009 to 2012 and senior policy advisor in education from 2007 to 2009. Huck has received several academic awards, including the George V. Kidder Outstanding Faculty Award and the Kropsch Maurice Award, Best Professor from the University of Vermont. The author of several books and co-author with Bernie Sanders of Outsider in the White House, he earned an M.A., and PhD in American Literature from Duke University. As I mentioned, he writes a newsletter about poetry, which is distributed by email and through the UVM listserv Poetry. He lives in Burlington with his wife, Buff Lindau. When I spoke with Huck, I started by asking why he began working on his poetry newsletter, which I believe he's been writing for almost 11 years. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
It had a strange beginning. I was an aide to Senator Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
I did his education work, and I used to sit in meetings of the HELP Committee, which is the Committee on Education, and all these people would talk about education based on position papers and based on who knows what. And I got more and more frustrated because I thought they didn't understand that there's a relation between learning and joy. So I would whip out my BlackBerry, those days when I had BlackBerries, and I'd find Wordsworth, and I'd quote them some Wordsworth, because Wordsworth is really, really great on the relation between poetry and joy and between learning and the joy of life. And it was like on deaf ears, but I started sending them, and then I became a chief of staff, so I sent to the chiefs of staff and people in the White House letters about poems. There's a kind of often forgotten now kind of memorial verses that Jonathan Swift wrote, and in it he put his epitaph, and it goes like this. He said, "Jonathan Swift left all he had to build a house for fools and mad and show by one ironic touch no nation needed it so much." He was talking about Ireland, where he had been born and where he was living. And I felt there was a need for people in the Senate to get so consumed by policy, to be in touch with whatever else there is in life. The residue of policy is life itself. And I think poems touch upon that. So I started sending them out, and I was full of energy, and I sent them out for a number of years. And then I went back to teaching. I sent them out irregularly. And then after retiring, I sent them out maybe once every 3 weeks. So I send out poems by poets who are often well-known. Some of them are dead. Having people read the poem and explaining the poems. Yeah. Explaining them not because I'm so smart, but because we have this terrible sense that when we come face-to-face with a poem, we feel small and stupid. And I don't think people should feel that.
Well, now, the subjects in your essays are varied. I really enjoy reading them. You talk about the poem. You talk about poetic structure by line and syllable and rhyme scheme and use of language. And, of course, you know, the theme or the poetic intent. But then you also,
right. You
sort of go off into small stories. You make comparisons with other poems that come to mind. And you
right. Allow
yourself to share your musings generally. And I enjoy that so much. It's not at all whatever one might be afraid of as far as difficult analytical reading. So I wonder if you have any kind of rubric for yourself as you work on an essay.
No, I don't. One of my very favorite poems is Wordsworth, who I hated when I first read him in college. But he says, In one of the lines of the prelude, he says, "In a world of life, we live by sense impressions not enthralled." I think we live in a world of life, of things, encountering other things. And for me, part of the world of life is the world of poems, of things that people have felt deeply and expressed in the best way they know how. And that touches on other things. And so it's a, I like to think of it not quite as a seamless web, but as a web of art and life and experience and problems. And I value poems a lot because they touch upon all of those things.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Wordsworth being one of your favorites. And another thing that I noticed, Rilke comes up a lot, and you say that he is always surprisingly to you one of your favorite poets.
Very surprisingly.
So talk about that.
Well, you know, Rilke is, first of all, the darling of heart-throbbing teenagers, which I don't quite get. but that, I don't mind that. He was a sponge. He lived off rich women. I don't think he was a very good human being. He had a child. He abandoned his child. He abandoned his wife. Mm. He was an aesthete of, you know, I just said, I think poetry is engaged with life. I think it was for Rilke, but he was very much in the aesthetic realm. So I come to Rilke unprepared for just how devastating he is. I think he really did live a life in which he pondered life and its relation to words. And he pondered those very deeply, and he resonates with me. So one of the things about poetry is one has to be prepared to listen to people one thinks one doesn't want to hear from. And Rilke's like that for me. He's taught me great things, and not from somebody who, you know, a lot of the poets one reads, if one met them, one would dismiss them. We have to get over that first impression that these are not our kind of people. And then they have much to tell us and much to reveal to us about ourselves.
Yeah. It's interesting. It sounds like you're not sure you would have respected who he was as he lived his life.
Oh, if I met him, I would have hated him. I would have gone to the other side of the room. If I met Emily Dickinson, I would have overlooked her. If I met Walt Whitman, another of my favorites like Dickinson, among poets like Rilke, I would have thought he's a dirty old man. I you know, but first impressions don't work. Right. It's the inner life that people are willing to let us into.
Yeah.
And I think the inner life of Emily Dickinson is immensely rich and, to me, immensely instructive about the courage people need to bring to this world when it hurts us.
Yeah, yeah. What you said about how, you know, he sponged off of wealthy women.
Oh, horrible man.
It reminds me, well, it makes me think that, you know, the opposite of that is like Eric Hoffer, who, of course, didn't end up being a poet, but much more of a philosopher.
Right. I know, but I don't think good people necessarily become great poets. I mean, there are good people among poets. I think William Carlos Williams, another of my favorite poets, was a doctor to poor families. And
right,
when
right, sure.
The population around him in Rutherford, New Jersey, changed from poor white to black to Puerto Rican, he just stayed there and ministered to people who needed health care and paid attention to their lives. He was a genuinely wonderful person. And one of his good friends was a man named Wallace Stevens, who lived in New Haven, was a corporation lawyer, lived for fancy fruit and I don't know, continental philosophers. I think I would have gravitated away from him at a party, too. And he writes extraordinary poems.
Yeah.
And the poems are not just about art like people think. They're about the poverty we feel inside ourselves and the desperate longings we have. So poets can surprise us.
Yeah.
All of us, each of us can surprise other people if we could only open up and take what is inside ourselves, our hopes and our fears and our desires, and be honest about them. And what makes great poets is that they have the words to do that. I mean, I think poets are a little like, if you'll pardon the analogy, like great basketball players. We all want to put basketballs in hoops, but only some people who practice and practice and practice. Michael Jordan did do that. And who have special gifts can do it at a level which just takes our breath away. So we all have poetry within us, but to be a great poet, to speak on the very deepest levels, Ralph Ellison says at the beginning of Invisible Man, who knows, but on the deeper frequencies, I speak for you. I think that speaking on the deepest of frequencies and finding adequate words for it is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it.
Yeah.
And it happens all over. It doesn't just happen to people who go to Harvard. You know, it happens to all sorts of people.
I think we can all forgive the basketball analogies because we're so desperate for basketball right now, right?
Well, we are, and I love basketball anyway. So.
Yeah. Now, in your most recent essay, or at least the most recent one as far as I'm aware, you write, and I loved this, there's a couple questions here. You write, "This is an odd essay. I began heading in one direction only to find myself along the way heading in an entirely different direction. Poems can be like that, not only elucidating the world to us and revealing us to ourselves, but encouraging dialogue. And dialogue, as we all know, is open-ended. Who knows where we will be left after the interlocution is over." And then you wrote, "And a warning, this is more political, overtly political, than any other letter I have written."
Right.
And you go on to talk about climate change and greed and the distribution of wealth and the possible Nazification of this country, which I was very interested in.
All out of Keats, right?
Yeah. So that was just very interesting to me. First of all, that you are obviously a political person, you've worked in Washington, but that these essays don't tend to become that political. But of course, lately it seems completely appropriate. But also, I loved the allusion to the fact that poems can meander, and your essay began in one direction. So I have, I guess, a couple questions there. You want to answer in any way you feel like?
Sure. You know, I think we have to be open to poems. And I don't want to pretend to you or your listeners that I'm open to everything. I'm, like most people, a little close to the world. But sometimes standing before a poem or sitting before a poem or reading a poem, we're led in directions we don't expect to be led. I already said that I don't expect to be led anywhere by Rilke, and I don't like him. But he takes me to remarkable places. And in reading Keats, I thought I would go one place, and I ended up another. And I think that's one of the things that poems can do. I taught for many years, for half a century at UVM, and for a lot of that time, I didn't quite, I think, know what I was doing. And I came to a very simple formulation about poems. Sometimes I think it's too simple, but I believe it deeply. I think poems either remind us of who we are, reaffirm our sense of self. There's a wonderful line in Walt Whitman in Song of Myself in which he says, "I do not say these things for a dollar, to fill up the time while I wait for a boat," right? And he's talking about, "I'm not just doing it for the money or to fill time while I'm hanging out. It is you talking just as much as myself, tied in your mouth. In mine, it begins to be loosened." And I think that's what poets do. They talk for us the things that we bury so deeply that we don't encounter or we're afraid to encounter or we've forgotten. That's one thing poems do. But the other thing they do is we're all a little wrapped up in ourselves. T.S. Eliot, as you've read my essays, I don't like Eliot much, but he says in The Wasteland, he says, "Each in the prison of his self." And I think that's true. We're all bound by our own experience and our own fears. And poems sometimes open us up to someplace else. You know, people other than you and me lived on this planet. They lived a long time ago. Some of them are of a different race or background. Some of a different religion. Some of a different sexuality. And sometimes poems can lead us to those places that we don't know. So that's my sense of poetry. It both reminds us of our deeper selves that we keep hidden, and it also opens us up to the possibilities of what human beings can be. That we in our limitations don't experience.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what Keats did for me. He led me places where I didn't expect to go.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the political nature of that essay, and I wanted to talk a little bit about where we are right now in the midst of this pandemic. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about poetry at this time and how it might help us, or who we might, you know, find comforting, or if comfort is what we should be seeking. I don't know, but what you think.
Sure. You asked me, for your listeners, Sheila's very good at preparing for these things, and she wrote me emails about things. And you asked me, you know, do any of these poems deal with the coronavirus pandemic? And I kind of flippantly said, not really. But I thought about it. The first poem I sent out was a poem I love a lot called Five Men by Zbigniew Herbert, who's a Polish poet who died a few years ago. And in the first section, five men are standing before a firing squad, and in the second section, the bullets move, and we see them actually fall. Nothing worse can happen than to be killed by a firing squad. But the third section, he asks, what did they talk about the night before they were shot? And he says, well, you know, they talked about the strangest things. I think he says, what did the five talk about? I'm reading from the poem here. What did the five talk about the night before the execution? Of prophetic dreams, of an escape in a escapade in a brothel, of automobile parts, of a sea voyage, of how when he had spades he ought not to have opened, of how vodka is best after wine you get a headache, of girls, of fruits of life. And then he concludes, it's an astonishing conclusion. Thus one can use in poetry names of Greek shepherds, one can attempt to catch the color of morning sky, write of love, and also once again in dead earnest offer to the betrayed world a rose. Mm. I think poetry functions in a world of executions, of deaths, of suffering, of difficulties. Sometimes it deals with those difficulties. That poem in particular does not shirk from the death by execution. Emily Dickinson writes, her most famous poem, I think, is After Great Pain, a Formal Feeling Comes. She writes of great pain. But they also show us that in the midst of all the suffering and all the difficulty, there's also beauty and joy. And those can come easily. I wouldn't trust them on the words of Donald Trump or, in fact, any other politician. But we do live our lives, and our lives not only in this pandemic time, but always are, you know, we're always going to die, and people around us are always getting sick. And yet life has both its joys and its terribly difficult insights into suffering. And that's what poems bring us. So I think they're needed in difficult times, especially in difficult times.
Yeah, you recently quoted from a Stevie Smith poem, "Not Waving But Drowning."
Oh, what a poem! Yeah.
Yeah, she talks about being in peril at every moment. That also made me think of this time. You know, it's not just new. We've always been in peril, although maybe a little more right now. So.
Well, I think we always have, and I think if one reads the statistics, coronavirus is not quite as bad as we think it. I think I take it very seriously, and it affects me very much. But it's partly mental. It's partly, you know, we're going to get ill and maybe die, and maybe people close to us are going to die, and maybe human life is not controllable, and yeah. Stevie Smith is right. We're in peril all that time, and we're not waving but drowning all the time, as she says in that poem.
Yeah. Now, in the poem you just quoted from, Five Men, what I'm really struck by is the detail of their night before and the varied places that it goes. It reminds me a little bit of the things they carried, that incredible story and collection.
Yep. One of the great things about poetry is it lays things against each other. We call them metaphors, and I think it's often the basis of poems that we don't normally associate with one another. We don't think entirely rationally. We leap from thing to thing, and I think poets reveal to us that extraordinary moment when the world is revealed by one thing being laid against another that we hadn't expected.
Yes.
No, I think that you're quite right about that poem by Zbigniew Herbert. He talks about, you know, that is what we talk about. Better to drink vodka than wine, you don't get a hangover. Better not to open with this kind of hand of cards. Maybe we do talk about women or men or, you know, but that's what we do.
Right.
And so poems can do that. They can talk about the things of life even in the midst of looming catastrophe.
Yeah.
And speaking of looming catastrophe, what one of the poems I didn't write about because it's too long and it's too beautiful is a poem called Sunday Morning by Wallace Stevens. And it's about an old woman or an older woman who sits in her chair and drinks coffee and looks at her rug and dreams of what it means that Christ died. It's an Easter morning poem. And in the last stanza, she talks about being free of that old catastrophe, which is death. And she says, "Deer walk upon our mountains, sweet berries ripen in the wilderness, till ambiguous flocks of pigeons sink downward to darkness on ambiguous wings." And we live in a world of beautiful, wondrous, joyous things, even though we're going to die, even though we get sick, even though cancer may be ravaging our bodies unbeknownst to us. Poetry faces into those things, even though it doesn't ever deny that we live in a world of catastrophe, that we live in a world of dying, of horrible, horrible things. Let me read you one of the shortest poems I wrote about, which I don't understand. One of the things I like about poems is I don't understand a lot of poems. And this is a poem by a man named Paul Celan. Was in a concentration camp. His parents died in concentration camps. One was shot, the other of typhoid fever. Mm-hmm. He survived and only to commit suicide after the war. But this is a poem called Once. And I think it's about God. Once I heard him, he was washing the world, unseen, nightlong, real, one and infinite, annihilated, they eyed, light was salvation. I have no idea what that poem is about, but I do see the image of God washing the world. And as Emily Dickinson does in the poem about God, inserting here a son, there eliminating a man. That's the way the world goes. People die. I don't mean to be callous.
You're right.
I think poems face up to that, that the world is full of difficult, horrible things like this coronavirus.
Yeah.
And yet it's also a world of joy and of beauty. I think every poem, regardless of what its attitude, and that's why I talk a little bit about prosody and about rhyme scheme, every poem has a beauty of its words. The words make an object that itself is beautiful. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have to stand before it and bow down, but the poem itself is a cry of the claims of beauty and the human mind imagining in the face of chaos.
Yeah. I feel like above all else, it's sort of just, it's an expression of that person's truth, which can appeal to a sort of universal truth that we all are kind of looking for at times.
Yeah, I'm not as sure, having grown older, about universal truths. I think there's a truth, as you said, deep down inside us, that is the truth of our life and of our experience. And if we express it, it resonates with other people who also have truths that they have found through long and often bitter experience. Not all bitter. I mean, some of it is wonderful, right? Poems are about love and joy as well as about death and annihilation.
Yeah. You have this. This takes us off of that subject, but I did want to ask before we're finished here.
Sure.
You wrote this wonderful line. You're writing about William Carlos Williams' very brief poem, Calypso 2, and you write, "I get complexity. Simplicity, well, it is sometimes hard to know what to make of it." And I loved that line. And
well, I love that poem. Thank you very much. That poem is, I have it in my head. Love comes up in the morning, and in the evening, zippy-zappy, it goes.
Yeah.
I suppose it's about love coming and going. You know, we could talk about the meaning of the poem. But what I love in that poem is the zippy-zappy. Where the hell did he get that? I mean, it's a line, you know, zippy-zappy. And it's so refreshing, you know, to encounter that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at this point, it's late in his life. He's a very, very great poet. I think he felt he was not sufficiently recognized. He was eclipsed by T.S. Eliot, as he probably shouldn't have been. I think he, not Eliot, turned out to be the great American poet of the generation because he embraced the American language, which you can get from Zippy Zappy, and because he embraced simplicity. And it's hard to be simple. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to when you ask people to write poems, so often they decide they have to rhyme and they have to be in kind of couplets, you know?
Yeah.
And to unlearn everything that we learned from Alexander Pope, who was an extraordinarily wonderful poet. I just, a couple of years ago, went back and read a lot of Pope. He wrote in couplets, only in couplets.
Uh-huh.
And they're extraordinary. Nobody ever wrote couplets that good. And we have to unlearn that. We have to unlearn a lot of what we think poetry is to come to our own, so come to your listeners, to our own inner voices. I over the years, I've thought a lot about what makes poets poets, and they're recognizable. They use language in such a way that can only be theirs, nobody else. Nobody would ever, ever, ever take a line by Emily Dickinson, one line, and think it was by Wallace Stevens. Every single, you know, group of two or three words sounds like her, or sounds like him, or sounds like Rainer Maria Rilke, or whoever it is. And I think finding that authentic voice, which is very, very hard. I'm not able to do it. I don't write poems. To find a voice that sounds like as if it comes from one's deepest, innermost being, which is different than anybody else's, which is why I'm not so sure about universal truths. I think that's very, very hard. When we get on the phone with somebody and they say, hello, how you doing? We know right away who it is.
Yeah.
Right? Even if we haven't talked to them for 10 years. They have inflections. And I think that's the way poems are. I think they're like phone calls, and we know right away who we're listening to. So part of what makes a poem is not just its theme and it's not just its structure, but it's that sense of voice, if I can use a fraught word, an authentic voice that comes from the poet.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you said you don't write poetry. I thought maybe I read somewhere that you did write poetry.
I tried, but it's hard, you know, to be authentic, to have one's own voice.
Yeah.
To have something come from deep within our self or psyche or soul or whatever you want to call it. I think it's very hard, and I just don't have it. I think I have something else, which is the capacity to read poems. We live in a world where people want to write poems, but they don't want to read poems. I think people have things to say to us, and I want to listen. Yeah. So I read poems.
Wonderful. Now, I know you found one poem with which you had been unfamiliar on a hike with your wife, Buff Lindau, and that was A Romance for the Wild Turkey.
By Paul Zimmer,
and that was a great poem. And then once Buff found an admirable poem about spring in a bathroom.
That's right.
Which is a great digression in one of your essays. So those were fun stories. But I wonder, where do you tend to find new poems mostly? Do you read journals or what do you do?
Well, see, that's a difficult question and a very good question. We did take this hike. There's a small hiking area we discovered near Burlington where we live. And somebody, as a project, a Colchester Library, put poems on posts and put them along the way. And when we went back, they were different poems. And I corresponded with the library, and I hope they'll do it in other parks. And you encountered poems, some good, some not so good. So that was one poem. It was just so striking. It was a poem about a wild turkey. And,
yeah, it's great.
And then the bathroom poem, we ate in a restaurant. We wanted to eat in Montpelier, and they had a couple poems up on the wall, and they were about spring. And I thought, whoa, these are really good. So, yeah, sometimes one encounters poems in strange places, and sometimes I'll open a book of poems. I was reading a book somebody gave to me, an anthology of a lot of poems, and I came to a very long poem called You on Bridge. And it was by a poet who I like a lot, but I'd never read it. And I was just so struck by the poem. I just went back to the anthology and read it again and again. I wrote about it. And one of the people on my list works for a publisher, and he sent it to the daughter of the guy who wrote it. He's dead now, but... and she said, yeah, it was one of my father's favorite poems. Right. I mean, it was so nice to hear that. So sometimes when it happens on poems, there are a lot of poems I read many years ago and didn't understand, and I come back to them.
Yeah.
It's been that way with Rilke and with Baudelaire and Rimbaud. I just come back to those poets, and I keep reading them and keep hoping maybe they'll break into some kind of understanding. And there's that wonderful moment sometimes when the sun breaks through the clouds and you say, oh, I get it. I know what this is about.
Yeah.
So it's all sorts of things. And I don't know. I know a lot of poems. Other than the Herbert poem, none of the poems I've talked about now are on paper before me. I mean, they occupy my head.
Right.
Sometimes I think, you know, I just got to revisit that and find out more about it.
Is that ever intrusive?
Nah.
Do they get on your nerves?
Not a bit. Nope, not a bit. Not a bit. Our lives are filled with a lot of crud, you know.
I
could tell you about baseball games and basketball games. I have friends who can cite baseball statistics from 1954. I mean, the stuff that occupies people's brains is immense.
Right.
So the space taken up by poems is not that great. And I have probably more space taken up than most people, but there are recipes and there are baseball statistics and there are newspaper articles. And
sure.
It's a very strange long poem by William Carlos Williams. An unsuccessful poem called Patterson. It's an epic poem, and in it he clips out things from newspapers and his library clippings, and I think that's the way our minds are. They have all sorts of stuff in them,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so one of the things in my mind, and I hope that's why I write these things, I hope in other people's minds, sometimes our poems, Matthew Arnold called them touchstones. He's out of favor now. There are things which a touchstone is like porcelain. You rub something against it and you see how hard it is, whether it can scratch a porcelain or the porcelain scratches it. I think poems are things we test our lives against.
Yeah.
And say, is this true? Is this not true? And it's sometimes the case that poems are not true, you know, that what they tell us is false.
Right. Well, like that... it's not that it's false, but like the zippy zappy line. In fact, you know, he had a happy long marriage. And your essay addresses this. William Carlos Williams had a very happy long marriage, and so it's unlikely that his experience of love went away zippy zappy the way he writes about.
Well, I was lying. He didn't have a long happy marriage.
Oh, he didn't?
He had lots of affairs.
Oh,
and the most beautiful poem he ever wrote is called Asphodel, That Greeny Flower. It's about 30 pages. It's a poem to his wife after he's had a stroke.
Oh.
And he says, you know, I'm really sorry that I fell away from you, and I'm coming back to you now because you're the bulwark of my life. And when we got married, the whole world opened up for me. And it's a gorgeous poem. It's a poem which acknowledges the frailty of his love and his having done things badly. So I'm not sure that it was a long, happy relationship. I think in the end, he deeply loved her. Mm-hmm. Her name was Florence, or he called her Flo. And he has a very short poem, which I used to read a lot. And I kind of totally ignored what it was about. I just loved the poem so much.
Yeah.
I teach it to all my students. It's called This Is Just to Say. That's the title, but it's part of the poem. This is just to say I have eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you are probably saving for breakfast.
Mm.
Forgive me. They were delicious, so sweet and so cold. Well, it's a poem of transgression. He ate the plums that were in the icebox. He shouldn't have done it, but they were so sweet, so delicious, so cold. I mean, it prefigures his relation with his wife and his troubles all his life, that he went after what was lovely. So, yeah, I don't think he had a happy, we all write things and maybe they're not true. I think he had a long marriage, and I think it ended up being a happy one. He asked for her forgiveness in Asphodel. He says, it's a gorgeous line. He said, what power has love but forgiveness?
Mm.
By it, what has been done can be undone. And, you know, it's a poem of asking for forgiveness. And at the end, he says, you have forgiven me. And then his love springs up. It's a gorgeous poem. I'd urge everybody who is listening to read it. It's called Asphodel, That Greening Flower, and it's in what's called tercets. That is three line stanzas, each line indented before the one before it, which became the dominant mode of writing in American poetry for a long time. And I think it's because of late William Carlos Williams.
Yeah. Before we finish up, Huck, I wanted to ask, who wrote You on Bridge? You mentioned that poem.
Yeah, it's by a poem called, the poet is called C.K. Williams.
Oh, yeah, C.K. Williams,
and,
sure.
And he's famous for kind of reinventing the long line. That is, the lyric poems tend to be short lines, and they're intense. And he realized, I think, following from the example of Whitman, although he doesn't say this, that long lines that go on and then fold into the next line can also be a way for the lyric consciousness to come to grips with itself. So he wrote a lot of wonderful poems, and that's really one of his most wonderful.
Okay.
And it's his coming to grips with what it means to be, in his case, Jewish, but what it means to be somehow different and a minority and always consigned to being different.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, great. Well, I'm going to put links on my podcast site to these poems that we've mentioned.
Oh, you're so sweet.
Yeah. And I also just want to say...
Can I say something to your listeners?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Shayla is really great. She wrote me emails about this. she really prepares well, as you can hear. That's unusual in this 21st century, where everything is, goes by tweet and Twitter and goes by fast. And I'm greatly admiring and appreciative of that.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice. And I just want to say I love the newsletter. I so admire it. And I want to tell people where they can subscribe to it. I think it says in your emails, you need to address an email to listserve@list.uvm.edu. And then in the body of the email... in the body of the email, what do they write, Huck?
I think you just say subscribe. I'm setting up a web page. Here's the bane of my life. I have a student who's arranging it for me, so it should be easier to sign up soon.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'll put that instruction also on the podcast site. I want to mention again, I've been speaking with Huck Gutman, and he writes a poetry newsletter on UVM's Listserv, and it's fascinating. And I just really appreciate your speaking with me today.
Thank you so much. It's been such a great pleasure.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Vermont author Stanley Huck Gutman. For information about his poetry newsletter, send an email to listserve@list.uvm.edu. And if you want to subscribe, you would simply write subscribe in the body of the email and follow that with your first and last name. So, for example, I would write, subscribe, Shayla Shapiro. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Huck Gutman, who writes, "The surprising subject of many, many poems of the past 200 years has been the need to pay attention to what is right in front of us, of what is so ordinary that we look at it, through it, but don't see it. In some sense, our lived reality is invisible to us. In our habitual movement through our lives, we don't pay attention to what is actually there in front of us and around us." So as a writing prompt, Huck suggests writing about something right in front of you that you don't normally see. For many, this is an object. For some, like Wordsworth, it is a person who seems ordinary, but who has that amazing spark that is the emblem of life. Huck writes, "Among the life of ordinary things is where our existence takes place. A poem can recognize that in the ordinary are the things that make our world. Write about such a thing." If you want to see what this looks like, lots of William Carlos Williams poems do this. So do a lot of poems by Elizabeth Bishop. So do remarkable odes to common things that Pablo Neruda wrote in the later years of his life. For ordinary people, there's Wordsworth. There's also that superlative writer, though not a poet, Anton Chekhov. So that's this week's Write the Book prompt, in the words of my guest, Dr. Huck Gutman. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. As we live through this unique period in history in which the entire world is basically in isolation, I hope that you're able to read and to write. And if possible, I hope you're able to support authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs and virtual book tours, and finding your way to their books. And for all of you who are trying to write while in isolation, do be sure to check the archives of Write the Book, because each episode offers a prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview. I'd love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have particularly good luck with any of our weekly Write the Book prompts, feel free to send it to me at writethebook@gmail.com, and if there's time, I will try to share it on the air. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.